Thank you so much for having me, especially to Deborah and to Connie. I'm really happy to be here. I'm qualified in that I know a lot about the time period, but I'm actually a little bit out of my league in talking about a novel. Because I teach 16th century literature and sometimes 17th century literature, I never teach novels because they weren't invented yet in England. So this is a treat. How many people have read Wolf Hall? Okay, so you might know then why I brought in this photograph. I took this last summer in England. This is an excerpt or a detail from an arras hanging, which was another word for tapestry in this period. In the book, tapestry comes up a couple of times that was owned by Cardinal Wolsey. This one, too, was owned by Cardinal Wolsey. Wasn't the one that Hilary Mantel describes in the book, but it sort of reminded me of the book with the little dogs. You know, Cromwell always has this little dog named Bella. So, I was in London the day before yesterday, so the bad news is that I am jet-lagged, a little bit sleepy, but the good news is that I'm freshly inspired to talk about this wonderful book, which takes place in London and its surrounding area in the early 1500s. So to get us in the mood, I thought I'd start by showing some photographs from my trip. Don't worry, it's not all my vacation photos. Okay, so these are places that come up in the book. So this is the Tower of London with all of the tourists shuffling in for their punishment. And toward the end of the book, there are some pretty big scenes here when Sir Thomas More is being held in the Tower and Cromwell is trying to get him to sign the Oath of Supremacy. This is also at the Tower. This is the Traitor's Gate, where the prisoners would be rowed up to in their boats. I'm assuming Cromwell himself was brought through this eventually, but I don't know that for sure. Okay, this is Hampton Court Palace, my Disneyland. I love this place. This was Cardinal Wolsey's palace. It later went to Henry VIII, either as a gift or something else. Retribution, we're not exactly sure. And toward the beginning of the book, Cromwell is summoned there in the middle of the night quite dramatically. And then this is the Great Hall in Hampton Court Palace. They have it set up as though for a royal feast, and you can imagine that Cromwell would have sat at a table very much like this one for royal celebrations and dinners and so on. Okay. So before I get into the book, I just thought I'd say a little bit about what I was doing in London this last time, because it is related. I was at the British Library transcribing manuscripts from the late 15th century. They wouldn't let me take pictures of the ones I was working on this time, but this is something very similar. So these were documents from the very beginning of the Tudor period when Henry VII was on the throne. So the Tudor period starts in 1485 when Henry VII defeats Richard III and seizes the crown. It ends in 1603 with the death of his granddaughter, Elizabeth I. Wolf Hall takes place roughly in the middle of the Tudor period when Henry VIII is on the throne. I get to London as often as I can to transcribe these manuscripts because experts think they're only going to survive about another 200 years. This is even with the best in lighting, the best in climate control. They are disintegrating quickly. And so people like me go over there and try to record as much as we can before it's lost to history. This is a scroll I was working with a couple of years ago, and it's the most amazing feeling to hold a scroll that you know has been carried through the Tower or carried through those palaces. And when I unroll documents like this one, I feel a real palpable connection to the history, and it's like all those hundreds of years just fall away. And I really feel like Wolf Hall gave me that same sensation. What Hilary Mantel has done is she's taken information that people like me go out and uncover, and she's managed to make it into this highly relatable story that just makes you feel like you're there. And so, I was really worried when I saw how big this book was, because I know so much about the period. I thought, there's going to be a lot of opportunities for her to get things wrong and shatter what Coleridge called the willing suspension of disbelief. But if she made historical mistakes, I didn't catch them. I thought it was extremely well done. Okay, so I'll start by giving you some brief background information. I don't want to just lecture. I'll be doing that enough in a couple of weeks. So if you have questions, please stop me. Or if you want to interject your own opinion, there's a lot of people here who have read the book, so I'll be interested to know what you think as well. Hilary Mantel is an English writer. She's had a very international and very interesting personal background, some social work in Africa, among other interesting things. Most relevant to Wolf Hall, I think, is the fact that she studied law at the London School of Economics. I do think she treats the legal issues going on at Henry VIII's court very well. She made them interesting even for me. I tend to get a little, as much as I love the period, I get a little bogged down with some of the legal stuff at times. Okay, she's written a number of novels, lots of essays, and also a memoir, and she's won a great deal of prizes. Wolf Hall has been the most celebrated. It won the Man Booker Prize in 2009, which is a very big deal in the UK, as well as the Walter Scott Prize. It was shortlisted for some other prizes, including the National Book Critics Circle Award here in the US. She herself has called Wolf Hall the book she was born to write. So that gives you an idea. She's very fond of the book as well. Wolf Hall is a fictional account of Thomas Cromwell, one of the most infamous figures in British history. Not to be confused with Oliver Cromwell, who is about a century later during the British Civil Wars. This is the portrait done by Hans Holbein the Younger that in the book Cromwell is sitting for. And when it's revealed to him, he's somewhat ambivalent, I think, about the portrait. And actually what I loved about that moment is he seems so surprised at his own appearance in the portrait. And I think that's spot on, because people in this time period didn't have mirrors the way we do. They had things that were called mirrors, but they really weren't very accurate. You know, the glass was quite different. So probably having your portrait done by Hans Holbein was the closest you were going to get to looking into a modern-day mirror like most of us do every day. So I liked that scene very much. So Cromwell was born around 1485. We don't really know, but we know he died in 1540. He was of a modest background, the son of a blacksmith and a trader. Merchant. But he went on to become the Earl of Essex. Now, in Henry VIII's reign, Henry did promote people quite a bit. But even so, this is pretty dramatic. Cromwell's rise was very unusual, and also one of the reasons why he was hated in that time period, and especially among the nobility at Henry's court. Okay. We don't know a whole lot about his early life. He went abroad, but we know he returned in 1512. And apparently while he was abroad, he was a soldier, an accountant, and a merchant. He did some cloth trading. He returned to England in 1512 and studied law. And then in 1520, at about the age of 35, he becomes legal secretary to Cardinal Wolsey. And Cardinal Wolsey was Henry VIII's right-hand man. He was really kind of running the show, especially when Henry was very young and was more interested in hunting and jousting than diplomacy. And Cardinal Wolsey lived a very grand and sumptuous life, especially for a clergyman. And anyway, Cromwell was very much a part of that, and you get to see that in the book as well. Wolsey eventually fell from grace when he failed to secure an annulment from the Pope for Henry VIII's first marriage to Catherine of Aragon. They'd been married about 20 years, but didn't have a son. They just had a daughter, Mary, who went on to be Mary the First. In fact, do I have a picture? Nope. Oh, yes. Luckily, while I was at Hampton Court this summer, we ran into Cardinal Wolsey and Thomas Cromwell. Who knew? They're still there. So that's Wolsey in his characteristic red, and that's Cromwell, and they're about to watch a joust. And the king showed up too, but okay. Looking here for my pictures. There we go. There's Henry VIII at the top and his six wives. The first four all have some relevance for Cromwell. Okay, so there's Catherine of Aragon, the second row here on the left. Henry, I won't get too much into the history unless you want me to, but Henry wanted to marry Anne Boleyn, who's in the middle there, and he needed, and he was trying to say that his marriage to Catherine of Aragon had never been legal, because she had been married to his older brother, Arthur, who died shortly after their wedding. And basically, the Pope said no, it was a legitimate marriage. And largely because of this, Wolsey was thrown out of Henry's service, died under kind of mysterious circumstances. What was so extraordinary is that Cromwell did not go down with his employer, with Wolsey. In the book, you see that, and in the book, even Cromwell is surprised by this, that rather than Wolsey's destruction being his as well, he goes on to become the king's minister. So he becomes... he becomes a member of Parliament. I have to check the date. Okay, yeah, he was officially made a member of Parliament in 1523, and then by 1532, he is the king's chief minister. And among his accomplishments, if you want to call them that, some do, some don't, among his accomplishments, he encouraged Henry to break with Rome and become head of the Church of England. He oversaw the dissolution of the country's monasteries, and largely because of this, he was very unpopular in England. Basically, he wanted Henry to be the richest king that England had ever had, and to do this, he went around shutting down monasteries and taking their wealth and books and manuscripts and so on. So people in these communities were watching the king's soldiers come in and basically pilfer their parishes. So he was deeply unpopular. But his big mistake seems to have been his support of the king's marriage to Anne of Cleves. She's down here in the left-hand corner. So Anne Boleyn doesn't last very long. She's executed within years of her marriage to Henry for treason. Henry, within days, or some say hours, married Jane Seymour. She's in the second row on the right, and she comes up in the book a little bit, and Wolfe Hall is actually the name of her family's estate. But she dies in childbirth with a son. She was Henry's favorite wife. She gave him what he wanted and promptly died. And then Cromwell, by now things are tricky. England has broken with Rome. They're susceptible to attacks by Catholic countries. So Cromwell felt that it was important that Henry marry a princess from a Protestant country. And so he came up with the German princess Anne of Cleves. And this marriage was a total disaster because Henry didn't like the way she smelled or looked and divorced her. Cromwell was charged with treason and was executed in 1540. So a very rapid rise followed by an even swifter fall. But this book focuses on his early years and especially the downfall of Wolsey. Yeah, like I said, I really think she did a great job with the history. So some of my favorite writers, including Shakespeare, are real escape artists. And when I teach Shakespeare, what I like to do is point out all the corners that Shakespeare paints himself into and then talk about how he gets out of them. So I always start with, just as an example, Midsummer Night's Dream, which starts with a forced marriage. Hippolyta is a war bride. And it's almost like Shakespeare said, how can I get my audience to feel good about this forced marriage by the end of the play? And I think he does, by and large. And what I most appreciated about Wolfe Hall is that the premise of the novel is such a challenge. I really feel like Hilary Mantel must have been a little mad to even start this project for basically three main reasons. So I thought I would talk about the three reasons why I think this book would have been a real challenge, and the three main reasons why it could have been a total failure, and also how I think she turns those into pluses. Okay, so first and foremost, the book is set in the 16th century, and more specifically, 1500 to 1535. The 16th century, especially the first part, it was just a different world from ours. It looked, smelled, tasted, sounded different. Different ideologies were in play. I mean, even I'm looking out at you all, and many of the colors that you're wearing, you know, you wouldn't have had clothing in those colors because the dyes haven't been brought back from the New World. Foods that we eat every day hadn't been brought back from the New World. It was just a very different time. And in particular, the language was very different. So in the 16th century, we have modern English. It's not Old English or Middle English. But as you saw, the handwriting looks very different. But also the organization of sentences are different. And they had a lot of vocabulary we don't have, just as we have a lot of vocabulary they didn't have. Like internet. So this poses a real challenge for people writing historical novels, at least if they want to have dialogue, and most of them do. You know, how do you have your characters in a historical novel speak? If you were to actually write the book written in 16th century dialogue, first of all, it'd take you forever, but secondly, it'd be really hard to read and to get through and would completely frustrate and alienate your audience, so that's not a good option. But if you have the people sound just like people today, most people would find that a little bit hokey as well. So what most people do, and I love reading historical novels of this period in my free time because I can convince myself that it's work. But what a lot of people do is they write it in mostly 21st century English, but they throw in an occasional archaic phrase like methinks that reminds us that we're reading something that was in a different time period. Hilary Mantel took a different approach and a really wise approach, and how she gets around this, or I think how she addresses this problem, is she chooses an unconventional point of view. So the novel is written in very close third person, but it feels almost like first person, especially because she constantly refers to Cromwell as he. She uses that pronoun he. It almost takes on a kind of I. And it's very confusing at first. And some Amazon readers have complained about this. But if you stay with it, you get used to it. And so I feel like what that does is it creates it creates a little distance. The reader immediately realizes we're in a very different world. It's a little bit confusing. It's hard to get oriented. But you get used to it and you get into the story. This is one of the techniques that has been the most remarked on in her positive reviews in places like The New Yorker. She's gotten a lot of praise for this. And I saw her in an interview, Hilary Mantel, that is, and she described it as putting a camera on Thomas Cromwell's shoulder so that you're just kind of seeing everything going on around him rather than being having the events narrated to you in a more conventional way. And I have an example of that. It's partly for this reason, it's a hard book to just read pieces from. And, you know, my job is to find pieces of things to read, and I actually had a difficult time with this book. So my husband found this passage, so thanks for that. Okay. What's going on here is that Cromwell is the king's minister at this point, and he has arranged for some kind of feast or festival. And he's got all these young guys working for him. Some are related to him. He's got Christophe, this French kid that he finds in a bar somewhere. Risley, who they call me Risley, is a secretary of some kind as well. Okay. He is hardly down into the body of the hall before Master Risley intercepts him. This is a big day for the heralds and their officers, their children and their friends, fat fees coming their way. He says so, and Calmy says, "Fat fees coming your way." He edges back against the screens, voice low. "One could foresee this," he says, "because Henry is tired of it, Winchester's grinding opposition to him every step of the way. He is tired of arguing. Now he is a married man, he looks for a little more decor. With Anne," he says, and Calmy laughs. "You know her better than me. If, as they say, she is a lady with a sharp tongue, then all the more he needs ministers who are kind to him. So devote yourself to keeping Stephen abroad, and in time he will confirm you in the post." Christoph, dressed for the afternoon, is hovering nearby and making signals to him. "You will excuse me," he says, but Risley touches his gown of crimson as if for luck and says, "You are master of the house and master of the revels. You are the origin of the king's happiness. You have done what the cardinal could not, and much more besides." Even this, he gestures around him to where the nobility of England, having already eaten their words, are working through 23 dishes. Even this feast has been superbly managed. No one need call for anything. It is all at his hand before he thinks of it. He inclines his head, Risley walks away, and he beckons the boy. Christoph says, "One tells me to impart nothing of confidence in the hearing of Calmy. As Rafe says, he go trit-trot to Gardiner with anything he can get. Now, sir, I have a message. You must go quick to the archbishop when the feast is done." He glances up to the dais where the archbishop sits beside Anne under her canopy of state. Neither of them is eating, though Anne is pretending to. Both of them are scanning the hall. "I go trit-trot," he says. He is taken with the phrase. "Where?" "His old lodging, which he says you know. He wishes you to be secret. He says not to bring any person." "Well, you can come, Christoph. You're not a person." The boy grins. He is apprehensive, does not quite like the thought of the abbey precincts, the drunken crowds at dusk, without somebody to watch his back. Unfortunately, a man cannot have two fronts. So that's an example of the camera on the shoulder technique that she nails in this novel. So aesthetically, I think she makes that a plus, the language issue. And in fact, I recognized actual lines from historical documents in this book, but they were interwoven so much that I found them easy to read. But she uses very simple prose in the book. It's not hard to follow. It's just her point of view is so unusual that it creates, like I was saying, that distance that I think you really need when you're writing historical fiction. But the other thing that I'm so impressed by is the way that this novel calls attention to how fascinating the early 16th century was. You know, usually people focus on Henry's love life, which was fascinating. And I love reading books and watching movies about Henry's love life. But there were lots of other things going on, too. And because she's chosen Cromwell, you get to see those things. You get to see the religious upheaval and especially the way the heretics or the so-called heretics are being prosecuted. And you also get to see the way the world economy is changing. And in fact, Cromwell understands this better than other people in England at the time because he's been abroad, he's been a cloth trader. He understands that just because England is an island country all off on its own doesn't mean you can be ignorant about what's going on in other countries and the trade routes that are opening up. And he's in the middle of all that. And so I liked that very much about the book. Okay, the second big problem for Hilary Mantel is that the book is about Thomas Cromwell, who has not fared well in the public imagination. He's almost always a villain in movies, and especially, did anyone see The Tudors, the Showtime miniseries? Well, he was pretty despicable in that. And some of the reasons that he was so hated, especially in his own time, I don't think are issues for us anymore. The fact that he came from modest background does not automatically make him the villain in today, like it did in the 16th century. He was accused of the sin of ambition and overreaching, And we don't see it that way anymore. Our people from modest backgrounds who end up achieving a lot, at least in this country, are almost always the heroes, right? But in this time period, it was very different. That's one of the reasons that he was so hated. And so I think Hilary Mantel is able to just kind of knock that one out of the water. This is a very sympathetic account of Cromwell. Not that he's entirely blameless. You do get some indications that there's some sketchy stuff going on with Cromwell and that he's done some sketchy things in the past. But so is everybody else, at least in the novel. And in context, it seems understandable, if not justified. And the language, that what she does with the point of view, helps us really feel like we're inside his head. So, you know, she says it's like being on his shoulder, but there are times when the narrator seems to jump right into his brain or something. And what strikes me about this is there's a lot of one of the themes throughout the book is memory. Cromwell has picked up some kind of memory system in Italy, and I don't know which one. I don't think it's ever described, but in Renaissance Italy, there were these various techniques for remembering things. So memory theater was one of them, where you would construct in your imagination an architectural space, and you would place things in it that you didn't want to forget. And Cromwell does something similar to this. There's one point in the book where we get this line, like a spider scuttles out with a piece of information, and it's clearly part of his memory system. But one cool thing is that phrases come back a few pages later. And I didn't catch it the first time I read the novel, but I caught it on the second time. So someone like the Duke of Norfolk will use an expression about his thumb, and then a few pages later, the same expression comes back. And what's happened is that the memory has been triggered. And so those are moments that feel like we're actually in Cromwell's head. And I think that when you feel like you're in someone's head, that person becomes a lot more sympathetic. So I think that's one way she's able to do it. But she also, she describes his very warm household at great length, his love for his wife, his great grief when she dies, his love for his daughters and his grief when they die. You get the feeling throughout the whole book that Cromwell is just extremely relieved and grateful to no longer be this boy from Putney that his father kicks around, to no longer be powerless. He just seems like a very grateful character. So I'll read a scene from his childhood. So he goes off occasionally to work for his uncle, who works in this great house at Lambeth. And there are young noblemen living at this house, including Thomas More. Cromwell, as a boy, works in the kitchens, and then occasionally he's sent back home to Putney, but with a present, some food or something to take to his family. Okay. One day, when he is nearly home, he finds the first Bella. Bella is always the name of his dog. He finds the first Bella lying in the street, and he sees that nobody wants her. She is no longer than a small-sized rat, and so shocked and cold that she doesn't even cry. He carries her home in one hand, and in the other a small cheese wrapped in sage leaves. The dog dies. His sister Bet says, "You can get another." He looks in the street but never finds one. There are dogs, but they belong to somebody. It can take a long time to get to Putney from Lambeth, and sometimes he eats the present if it's not raw. But if he only gets a cabbage, he kicks it and rolls it and thrashes it till it is utterly, utterly destroyed. At Lambeth, he follows the stewards around, and when they say a number, he remembers it. So people say, if you haven't time to write it down, just tell John's nephew. He will cast an eye on a sack of whatever's been ordered in, then warn his uncle to check if it's short weight. At night at Lambeth, when it's still light and all the pots have been scoured, the boys go outside onto the cobbles and play at football. Their shouts rise into the air. They curse and barge into each other. Until somebody yells to stop, they fight with their fists and sometimes bite each other. From the open window above, the young gentlemen sing a part song in the high, careful voices they learn. Sometimes the face of Master Thomas More appears. He waves to him, but Master Thomas looks down without recognition at the children below. He smiles impartially. His white scholar's hand draws close the shutter. The moon rises. The pages go to their truckle beds. The kitchen children wrap themselves in sacking and sleep by the hearth. He remembers one night in summer when the footballers had stood silent looking up. It was dusk. The note from a single recorder wavered in the air, thin and piercing. A blackbird picked up the note and sang from a bush by the water gate. A boatman whistled back from the river. So we get these glimpses of his early life, and we see the way everything comes back, because Thomas More figures largely in Cromwell's life later on. And of course, Thomas More doesn't remember the time at Lambeth, but Cromwell does. So if Hilary Mantel's point of view in this novel has received a lot of attention, her treatment of Sir Thomas More is the other thing that has received a lot of attention. Sir Thomas More is typically valiant in portrayals of him. You know, portrayals of him are typically valiant in film and in the play A Man for All Seasons. You know, he is, after all, Saint Sir Thomas More. And in this book, he's pretty much a misogynistic psychopath. I mean, he's really frightening. And I have to say, I teach Thomas More's Utopia. I'm extremely fond of that text, and I love teaching it. But Thomas More was a complicated duck, far more so than a lot of the fictional portrayals of him would suggest. And even my students, when we read Utopia, they say, you know, does he just have a sick and twisted sense of humor, or was he sick and twisted? And it's hard to know. And I think that Hilary Mantel's portrayal of him straddles that line. It's not, she has defended herself and said that it's not entirely unsympathetic. And I think that's true, but it is, she goes for it. She focuses on the way he persecuted people, that he was really zealous about people he felt were heretics. He himself decided who he thought was a heretic, tortured people, you know, was not above all of that. And yes, he was this great humanist, but toward the end of his life, which is what she's writing about, you know, some dodgy things had happened to the point that his great friend Erasmus had stopped writing to him at this point in his life. So she really goes for it. And she uses these two characters to contrast against each other. I think they're both richer characters for the other in this novel. And I think that, you know, she ends the book on the evening of Thomas More's death, and I think that was a wise move, because he really supplies a lot of the emotional force in this novel. So I just thought I'd read one more quick passage. This is an encounter between the two men. And they're... I'll skip some of it, but they get into this conversation about William Tyndale, who's been translating the Bible into English, and More is absolutely livid about this. There's a warrant out for his arrest in England, so he has fled to Europe, because that's illegal in this time period to be reading the Bible in English. Okay. Spring 1528. Thomas More, ambling along, genial, shabby. "Just the man," he says. "Thomas, Thomas Cromwell, just the man I want to see." He is genial, always genial. His shirt collar is grubby. "Are you bound for Frankfurt this year, Master Cromwell?" "No. I thought the Cardinal might send you to the fair to get among the heretic booksellers. He is spending a deal of money buying up their writings, but the tide of filth never abates." More, in his pamphlets against Luther, calls the German shit. He says that his mouth is like the world's anus. You would not think that such words would proceed from Thomas More, but they do. No one has rendered the Latin tongue more obscene. "Not really my business," Cromwell says, "heretics' books. Heretics abroad are dealt with abroad, the church being universal." Then they get into this conversation where they're sort of trying to trap each other into confessing that they've read Tyndale and these other so-called heretics, but Cromwell easily sidesteps this and manages to not get in trouble. So there's a passage about that that I won't read, and then Moore beams at him. Well, after all, it's spring. We shall soon be dancing around the Maypole. Good weather for a sea voyage. You could take the chance to do some wool trade business. Unless it's just men you're fleecing these days. Well, that's ouch. You know, it's a reference to his humble background and also to his current politics. And if the cardinal asked you to go to Frankfurt, I suppose you'd go. Now if he wants some little monastery knocked down, when he thinks it has good endowments, when he thinks the monks are old, Lord bless them, and a little wandering in their wits, when he thinks the barns are full and the ponds well stocked with fish, the cattle fat and the abbot old and lean, off you go, Thomas Cromwell, north, south, east, or west, you and your little apprentices. If another man were saying this, he'd be trying to start a fight. When Thomas More says it, it leads to an invitation to dinner. Come out to Chelsea, he says. The talk is excellent, and we shall like you to add to it. Our food is simple, but good. Well, that's a little glimpse of the repartee between Thomas More and Thomas Cromwell. Okay. And then finally, the last reason that I think this book posed a real challenge is that it ends before Thomas Cromwell's life does. You would think. It's such a big book. I assumed that it was the life of Thomas Cromwell, but actually she doesn't get that far. So all the really juicy stuff, Anne of Cleves and, you know, the monasteries and the execution, most of all, don't happen here. Apparently, she is writing the second part. It's called The Mirror and the Light. She's been working on this. But I wouldn't say that Wolf Hall felt like, you know, to be continued, .. What I actually liked about where she stopped is that it gives you the impression that Cromwell will always get back up on his feet. That, you know, he gets knocked down, but he gets back up. Of course, that wasn't true in the end, but it leaves you with that idea. Actually, that's rather Shakespearean, too. But yes, so let's see. What if I... Just a couple more pictures before we go to questions. This is a council room, like the kind that Cromwell might have been part of. This is at Hampton Court Palace. That's a cloth of estate. In one of the passages I read, Anne Boleyn is sitting with the archbishop under a cloth of estate. That's what they're talking about. Here's Thomas More and his family, painted by Hans Holbein. That comes up in the book as well. Thomas More is the second one from the left. And then this is from that TV show I mentioned, which apparently you're all too highbrow to watch, but I watched every second of it. And this is Thomas Cromwell being taken off to be executed. I always close my eyes during those parts, so I don't know how they executed him, but I think they chopped his head off in the film. So that's a light from Hampton Court Palace with Henry VIII standing very proudly there in the stained glass. So I'd love to talk about the book with you or answer questions or hear what you thought about it. Yeah?
Why the title? They spend very little time in Wolf Hall. Why the title?
Yeah, good question. He asked, why the title? You know, I wondered that myself. And so when I read the book the second time, I really paid attention to any reference. What happens, there's some scandal at Wolf Hall. This is Jane Seymour's family. There's some scandal that happens there. I have sometimes wondered if maybe it's the title that is setting us up for another installment, because he's heading off to Wolf Hall at the end of the book. You get there's the suggestion that he's interested in Jane Seymour for himself, and of course she's going to capture the fancy of the king, so I can't wait to see how that goes down in the next book. So I think perhaps that's a gesture to the next part. Maybe just, you know, wolves sounds kind of scary and treacherous. I don't know. Yeah.
There was actually a quote somewhere near the end of the book. I don't speak Latin. It was like, hominus, homini, lupus.
Okay.
Men treat men like wolves.
Yeah.
And some of the descriptions in there of how they would torture and kill the heretics was horrible. I wish I could close my eyes when I was reading.
Yeah.
Was really that really brought to me how different that culture was, at least from ours.
Yeah, so she's pointing out, for those that didn't hear, that there's a Latin phrase later in the book that I don't remember word for word, but it's about men treating men like wolves and all the treachery that's going on at that time period. So, yeah, that's reflected in the title of the book as well. Yeah, other questions or observations? Yeah, Deborah.
Would you mind telling us a little bit about your work with tapestries?
Oh, sure. So I've been working on this book for a very long time. It's near conclusion. I'm talking to editors now and publishers now. But basically, throughout Renaissance literature, especially Shakespeare and Spenser, there's lots of references to heiress hangings, and no one has really ever paid attention to them. But when you go to one of these palaces in England and you see these enormous tapestries, I mean, they're 30 feet wide. They were the most cherished objects. Some of these series cost as much as a new battleship. Extremely expensive, covered with imagery, and they were very much a part of people's lives. They were used in celebrations and so on. So my book is providing the context, and basically, I argue that Renaissance writers were trying to write narratives that were like tapestries, that were similar to tapestries in structure and sort of the way they presented narratives, rather, you know, in a non-linear fashion, and so on. So I'm quite excited about it. I'm looking forward to it coming out and being done with. But it's been a real passion of mine for many years. I've traveled all over Europe looking at tapestries and looking at archives having to do with tapestries. So I just loved the scenes in here with Sheba on the tapestry. I thought, she's got it. You know, you can't have a book this size about the early 16th century at Henry VIII's court and not talk about a tapestry. It's just, it would have been the highlight, you know, of these many people's visits to court. So I thought, that's good. She totally got it. But she's British, so they see tapestries in their you know, school field trips and things like that, and over here we don't. Yeah. Yes.
Did you feel that the Tudors was fairly authentic?
No. You mean the TV show? Oh no, it was terrible. I mean, it was not terrible, but the history was terrible. You know, the history was awful, which is what I warn my students who think that they can, you know, not study for the exam by watching season one of the Tudors. But no, they rearranged the history for dramatic effect. But again, one thing that's so great about Wolf Hall is she didn't seem to need to rearrange the history. You know, she told a good story without having to conflate things. And she doesn't even talk about Henry's love life all that much, and yet it's still really riveting. So I think that was a real accomplishment. Yes?
One of the things that was interesting to me was Cromwell's attachment to his own family, mm-hmm. his wife Elizabeth, and then mm-hmm. the two daughters that die. And it seems to be recurring to him.
That's right.
His relationship with others as he moves through the book.
That's right. She points out Cromwell's love for his family and how it recurs with him throughout the book. Yeah, and he has a lot of sympathy for people going through similar experiences. And I don't know that there's a lot of research to support that. I just don't know. I've done work on Wolsey, but not on Cromwell in particular. Cromwell didn't leave much of a legacy. He wasn't a self-promoter in print the way someone like Thomas More was. So I don't know if what she's based that on, but it works really well, and it helps us to connect with him, that in this time when, you know, people are getting their heads chopped off left and right, it seems like, at Henry's court, that there are these really intense, loving family relationships, and that Cromwell in particular seems to have those. Works really well. Yes?
She sort of rehabilitates Cromwell. At least a lot of people have this other view of him. He's the mm-hmm. villain.
Right.
A very evil person. How imagination is she using in doing that? Is there records that substantiate?
Right, that's a good question. He's saying, you know, she rehabilitates Cromwell in this book. Rather than a villain, he's very sympathetic. And is there evidence for this? And, you know, I don't know. although I've just been in the British Library for 3 weeks, I had other things to look at. So I don't know. But again, I think she's used the fact that there isn't a lot existing about him to her advantage. I do think that. And certainly some of those scenes, like where, if people who have read the book recall, when he's talking about the angel wings that were his daughters, I mean, of course, that's, I doubt very seriously there's any evidence for that. So I think probably those moments are highly, you know, fabricated. But at the same time, I think that the book in part answers the question of how does he go from where he was to being the Earl of Essex? You have to have certain attractive characteristics, or people are just not going to want to have you around. And lots of people wanted to have Cromwell around, and it wasn't always just because they were afraid of him. So I think that in part she's trying to connect the dots, and she does that by making him this sympathetic figure. Yeah?
Henry VIII as being a psychopathic despot or something. Do you have any feelings about that? Do you think
he was
wrong for his time?
Well, okay, so my husband sitting in the back row has told me that he thinks that I was Henry VIII in a previous life, which is not something you want your spouse to say. I think I was not behaving well that week. I am fascinated by Henry. Yes, horrible. He did a lot of horrible, horrible things. I would never say that he didn't. However, I think what gets downplayed by some accounts of Henry VIII is the vulnerability of his reign. You know, his father had seized the throne. There were people in England that were better placed than Henry VII to be king after the death of Richard III. Henry VIII had a legitimate claim through his mother, who was Richard III's niece, but for whatever reason never played that card. You know, he presented himself as his father's son. And for this reason, there were a lot of people in England who wanted to see him put down, and like the Plantagenets or some other family that had a better claim to the throne in place of him. And so having a son really was, he thought, essential. Now, there's a new book out. I haven't read the whole thing. I've just read the beginning. What's it called? Speaking of wolves, She-Wolves, or something like this, about female monarchs in Europe at the time. That author has pointed out that actually, in other countries, women were ruling just fine, thank you very much. And why did he seem to think he needed this son? But he did. In England, having a son was still everything to ensure the survival of your dynasty. And so it was a serious problem. And he wanted a son to prevent civil war. And I think that gets downplayed a lot. He did have legitimate reasons for at least divorcing Catherine. I don't know about some of the others. But he's a very charismatic figure, you know, and he was very well educated, was a great musician, patron of the arts. It's hard not to kind of like him, I think. So, okay. Yes, one more.
What do you think of the depiction of Anne Boleyn and her shrewdness and her ability to
Yeah, so he's asked me about what I thought about Anne Boleyn. Well, speaking of that ties to your earlier question about the evidence, and I think actually her portrayal of Anne Boleyn is based on evidence. People really didn't like her. They just really didn't like her. Although even the people who didn't like her didn't think she was actually guilty of the things that she was executed for, but you know, shouldn't have been killed for being unlikable. But her portrayal of Anne is one of the things that I felt was based very much on firsthand accounts from the time. So I think that was pretty spot on. Okay. Well, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of this year's series.